News.
It's 200 years since they invaded Aboriginal land.
The land belongs to us. We belong to the land.
Government is trying to take away from us.
Don't call me a problem. I am not the problem. I have never left my country, nor have I ceded any part of it.
Let's talk. Triple A's flagship program that continues to elevate the diverse voices of First Nations people across the country. Centered around the unceded sovereignty of First Nations people in this country, honouring the history with a solutions-based focus on the future. With your host, Pomeroy journalist, Danny Tierce Johnson.
Yama, hello and welcome to Let's Talk. Very special day here today. I'd like to start the show by acknowledging country. I acknowledge the traditional owners from the lands that we broadcast from, and I'd like to pay my respects to their elders past and present, and I extend that acknowledgement all across this beautiful Black Nation today, particularly up to the community of Walgett, where my guest comes from today. A long, a beautiful connection to Walgett. Gomeroi man Corey Tutt is the CEO of Deadly Science. They're a non-profit organisation dedicated to providing science resources and early reading material to remote schools in Australia. He's been doing this for a couple of years now. But he's here for the Brisbane Writers Festival, which kicks off this week. And he has just authored the book, or a couple of months ago, called The First Scientists, Deadly Inventions and Innovations from Australia's First People. Corey Tutt, welcome to the show, my brother.
Yami, you mob. Thanks for having me.
First of all, your mob and your country, brother.
So I'm a Gomeroi man, and my country is Walgett and Lightning Ridge. Yep. And I grew up in actual Yuin country down in Nowra, but I got connections up there, and yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it's nice to finally meet you. We had you on the show a month ago. We're talking about your partnership with McLaren, and you got to go down to the Australian Grand Prix, and the Deadly Science logo was everywhere. Just to recap that yarn, brother. How was that for you, going to the Australian Grand Prix and having Deadly Science logo, Blackfella logo, all over the world?
It was pretty wild, actually. I still pinch myself. It feels like a bit of a dream and a bit of a whirlwind that it happened. But, you know, like all good yarns, I remember telling my cousin about being on McLaren and my phone autocorrected to McCarran. but, you know, it's still, you know, for, like, the opportunity to showcase, you know, Blackfella STEM and on a worldwide stage, the largest ever STEM project in the world, and Formula One is a huge STEM project. You're trying to, you know, work out ways to cut friction in the air. But I'm like, you know, I said to the mob at McLaren, I'm like, hey, look at our boomerangs. You want a fast car? Look at them. They cut through the air. But, you know, we've got science too that. You know, they model their cars off a water bottle because the water bottle's got the top and it basically cuts all the air and makes the car faster so you use less fuel. But I'm like, hey, you know, have a look at our stuff, you know.
Yeah. Never thought a water bottle would be aerodynamic.
It's pretty crazy.
You know, if you don't throw it through the air, you drink it.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But, you know, like it was good to educate them because they come out to Australia every year, but they very rarely do stuff with Blackfellas. Mm. And we were able to, you know, connect them with schools in remote communities. So I think it was the Wicking House, Aramanjara, the Groote Eylandt kids. Were able to tell them, hey, like, this is, you guys should be doing acknowledgement of countries. You know, you should be getting someone in to, when you do your events and stuff, you know, this is, you're on Blackfella land, you know. And when you're here, you know, I'm going to give you something that makes you think of Blackfellas every time you're here. And I hope that I did that. I hope I did that for, you know, the Blackfella world that, you know, this race, this worldwide car race, when they come here, it means more than, you know, it means more than just coming here for a car race. You know, you got to pay your respects to the traditional owners, and that's what I really wanted to do. And to, you know, Daniel Ricciardo's credit, he was real good. He's a real staunch ally of our people, you mm-hmm. know. And
great to hear.
We had a good yarn about it, and he, you know, he said he wants to do more when he gets out of here, and he was really good about it. He gave us a lot of his time, which is nice.
No, it was really great. You know, it's just so positive to see. You know, because you've worked so hard on Deadly Science over the years. You're only a young fella, you know.
Thank you. And I'll pay you later for that.
Though. Yeah. Black don't crack, they say in Walgett. No, but, you know, it's been a couple of years and you've really built Deadly Science out of nothing to where it is today. You know, everyone knows about Deadly Science and about Black STEM, and it's really changed for me, it's really changed the thinking of young people that they don't have to be just be footy players or sports stars, but they can actually be science stars as well. And I think that's helped change, flip the narrative for parents and kids out there, and I think that's a really wonderful thing.
You know, I was talking to some young kids, you know, again, yesterday. It was we're doing a Zoom session, and I said to them, you know, how about you do some eDNA? And they go, no, we can't take eDNA. And I'm like,
what's eDNA?
Have you been doing any rat tests lately? Yeah, yeah. Well, you're doing an eDNA kit then. So yeah, eDNA is taking a rat test is taking the DNA of a COVID virus, and you test it to see if it's there.
Yep.
So, you know, just by doing rat tests, you could do an eDNA test. And eDNA basically is you can take samples of water or soil and you can test what animals have been there or what plants. Right. Just by looking for the sequence in the DNA. But, you know, these all black fellas have a natural epiphany of science. We just call it caring for country.
Yeah.
Because we care for mother country. And the country in turn cares for us. You know, provides food, provides shelter, provides everything we need culturally to survive and thrive.
Mm.
So, you know, it's real easy to get black fellas into STEM because we've been doing it for 65,000 plus years. The hard bit is trying to, you know, get the order, the old white man, to believe that we're more than just hunter-gatherers. And you know, like to an extent, Bruce Pascoe's helped with Dark Emu, but then it's not the be-all and end-all. Actually, you know, we celebrate around the world the Mona Lisa, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Mona Lisa is about the size of a matchbox.
Is it?
Yeah, it's tiny. And it sits behind Perspex glass.
It has little tiny little fingers to draw it.
Oh, yeah. Like a little toothpick. But, you know, that sits behind Perspex glass, and it has to be handled and has to be re-oiled, and it's only 534 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, our art has lasted on rock faces that have been exposed to the elements for thousands of years.
Mm.
You know, there is a chemistry behind that.
Yep.
There's a chemistry behind our song lines. There's a chemistry behind our being as people. And so, you know, when we say we're the first chemists, we are. First social chemists, you know, you walk down any Coles or Woolworths, you see Baralum, which is the tea tree oil.
Yep.
You know, and I love it when, you know, non-Indigenous people say, how do I embed First Nations knowledges into the curriculum? And I go, do you have ants in your house? Oh, yeah, sometimes. And I'm like, there's two reasons why you have ants in your house. One, you're a grub because you're not cleaning your kitchen. But the other reason, it's going to rain. And we know that black fellas and all across Australia used ants to predict the weather for rain because ants have a chemical. They smell when the rain's coming and they move. Especially if they're low-lying, they'll move and they'll protect the nest. So they'll actually move up to higher ground. So, you know, that stuff comes from blackfellas. And it's been ingrained in, you know, the non-Indigenous people who know that from blackfellas. So, you know, the science has always been there. It's always been around. Well, we've known about the fish traps. We've known about all this other stuff.
Yep.
You know, and it's just like, it's pretty funny. It's like going to a party and being like, oh, you know, recognising all the people you've known for years and pretending like you've just met them for the first time.
It's true. It's like, hey, we're waiting for the, you know, the non-Indige scientists and to catch up.
Yeah.
You know, because we know, but then they got to do all their tests and their theories to sort of prove what we already know, you know what I mean?
Well, Danny, name another culture on Earth where we call our second and third cousins cousins. And we have the family tree is so big that we know who we're related to, you know. And it's when we don't know is when it's a problem. But for us, it's, you know, we're constantly, you know, we are the most socially evolved race on Earth because we're able to know who our family is in different parts of Australia. You know, just going up here to Brizzy, you know, I've caught up with relatives that I didn't even know existed, including, you know, and that. Already.
Yeah.
So, you know, we know who we're related to. We have complex, you know, social relationships, and that's just really important.
Yeah. It's helped sort of sustain, you know, the oldest sort of surviving living culture, you know. Brother, you're up here for the Brisbane Writers Festival this week.
I know, I'm shocked too.
Read and write, Corey. we have an event which I'm facilitating tonight. It's called The Story of the Stars. Now, it's about the book that you've released, and I love this, The First Scientists, Deadly Inventions and Innovations from Australia's First People. And shout out to Black Douglas, who illustrated the book. It's absolutely amazing artwork in it. Why did you put this book together? I know it's a simple question, but I think there's a little underneath story to this.
Yeah, I mean, when I started Deadly Science, I was working in Redfern and Waterloo, and I was working with all these young, deadly blackfellas and girls as well that loved, you know, they just loved all things science. And I end up sending books out to remote communities, and I just got sick of sending the same old stories, you know, Albert Einstein, Thomas Edison, you know.
Yep.
And the image of what we see as scientists, you know, I asked some non-Indigenous kids yesterday what a scientist looks like. And they said to me, white lab coat, white man, old,
yep,
glasses, which I was kind of offended by because I wear glasses. But for me, you know, they were the images that they said. It was never young women. It was never young black fellas. It was, you know, and for me, that's why I wrote the book, because I wanted to change what a scientist looks like, because the truth of the matter is scientists come in all different shapes and sizes, all different colours. Black fellas were the first scientists in this country. And, you know, we have 65,000 years of knowledge that doesn't just disappear overnight. It can't be written off. You can't put a bit of white out over that 65,000 years and say that, you know, that it doesn't exist, because we know it does. Mm. And I really wanted to send a book that, you know, when young people read it, they see themselves in. And because, you know, the notion is you can't be what you can't see, and some people might not agree with that, but it's so true. Because if we say to particular people that, hey, you know, science, you need to be smart, and your people aren't smart, then they're not going to do it. Mm. They're not going to believe they can do it. And you know why they're all in lab coats in the book? Because Twitter is the biggest bridge where all the trolls hide under and they sleep. And one guy says to me, he goes, if your mob was such great scientists, how come they didn't wear lab coats? So I'm like, you know what? Me and Black are going to help you here. And we're going to put all the mob in lab coats, because it is science.
Yeah, we're looking at a picture now and it's mob sort of in a corroboree sort of setting, dancing under the sun and the sky and in lab coats. And it looks really cool.
Yeah, and I wanted to make
it. It's that metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know? We're ancient, we're cultural, but we're still scientists.
Yeah, 100%. Right? And I wanted to do it in a bit of a, you know, a different style, because, you know, for me, we've come a long way. Like in the last, you know, 10 years ago, we weren't doing acknowledgement countries. We weren't doing welcome. I mean, admittedly, they're not great sometimes, the acknowledgements, but, you know, we are slowly getting better with the next generation of non-Indigenous people. Our role is to you know, not let them know the cultural stuff that is ingrained in our being, but let them know about the true history of this country and the true history of STEM in this country, so that they can grow up, you know, knowing that this is the history of this country and they should be proud of it. Mm. And for me, when we do that, then that's how we really close the gap, is because we need to get people, you know, working together, not working against each other. Yeah. And for me, you know, when I wrote this book, it was, I just really wanted to give kids a book that they could be proud of. And on the front cover, you'll notice it's a bit orange and it's got a bit of black speckles on it. But that acknowledgement of country, I wrote when our country was burning. And it's probably, you know, it's pretty important. And it's, there's one line in there, and it's, you know, if you care for country, the country will look after you. And I wrote that when the fires were happening, because I was on a bus and I was watching, you know, this huge fire just rear up, and it was just burning the countryside, and it broke my heart. Eh?
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly people forget about the impact of those fires and all the natural disasters we've had leading up to the pandemic. And when I still drive out to country now, you know, when I leave Meanjin and I drive back to country, you can still see the land is scarred years after those disasters, you know. But with all this climate change stuff that we're seeing at the moment, like, it's going to come back around again. And we're seeing that over in Turkey at the moment. You look on the other side of the world, people, that's what's going to come here next year. It's just crazy what's going on around.
And even like the Cabo mob, right, the Cabo Trion mob, shout out to Auntie Dion Anderson. You know, they lost everything.
Yeah.
They lost
Cabbage Tree Islands down there on Bunjalung country, just near Ballina, just for a mob that don't know.
But they lost everything. They lost absolutely everything. And, you know, we've got to, like, the people that have lost everything, and even the Wallaga Lake mob, the Cobargo mob, the South Coast mob, they're still reeling from the fires.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not going to go away overnight. Then, you know, we look at the you know, the Walgett mob, the all the mobs that, you know, affected by the drought. You know, like, we've got to, something's got to give so we can look after this country and this planet better, you know?
Yeah, and I think education is a key, and the more young people we have in schools reading books like this, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, I never had an Aboriginal book at school. The old dreaming stories with the frog drinking all the water.
Tiddlywink.
must have been named after Barnaby Joyce. I don't know, because he stole all the water too. But
it looks like he's got a bit of water in him.
Yeah. But, you know, it's having these sort of books in schools and having kids armed with the cultural knowledge, and not only our kids but non-Indigenous kids as well, because the chapters are named the first, you know, and I just love it. The first astronomers, the first engineers, the first forensic scientists, you know, the first chemist. And I just love this because it just embeds that that thinking that we are the first at this sort of stuff, that all the stuff that we look at non-Indigenous people doing in the terms of the science world and careers, it's actually we started it.
Yeah, you know what's interesting, right? I said, so back in Port, where I live, Port Macquarie, I had this non-Indigenous person said, "Why are you black fellas so angry?" So I brought back the point, right, and it's in the book, but around the first forensic scientists. Now, 50 years after colonisation, nine or so non-Indigenous kids go missing in the bush in Victoria, and there's thousands of stories like this. 50 years after, you know, white people came here and committed atrocities against our people, blackfellas still found those kids, saved their lives.
Yep.
That says everything about our people and our culture, right there and then. Okay, actually, if you look in the mirror, you'll see who's angry.
Yeah.
You're the angry one. We're the ones that are just trying to get you to understand something that's a bit deeper. And, you know, to her credit, she's like, you know what, I really thought about what you said and you know, it actually changed her way of thinking. Yeah. And, you know, you're never too old to change the way you're thinking. You just need to be, you just need the right chemistry of words to deeply listen.
Because you think about that, the first forensic scientist, right? You don't think about it in context until I talk to you, but you think of those CSI shows, right? Crime scene investigation.
Spraying aluminum
over
it.
Our backtrackers were the first CSI shows. It should be CSI Alice Springs or whatever, you know. But I remember the story of, it was a similar one, a young girl, white girl, was kidnapped in Adelaide in the 80s. No, it was actually the 70s, sorry. And it was a huge, massive national story. And they actually brought in this black tracker from down Alice Springs way, and he found her and the person that stole her and solved this, you know, national mystery and whatnot. But, you know, it just goes to show that our skills with this, that is forensic science.
Well, you know,
learning how to track and trace.
We just had Anzac Day, right? And it was great to see all the photos of all the black fellas that have fought and served for this country, and that's great. But, you know, we had the 51st Battalion in the Torres Strait. Mm-hmm. We had the Nakaroos, the North Force. Yep. You know, these were mob that protected this country from being invaded. Mm-hmm. You know, if it wasn't for these black fellas, these deadly black fellas, and even though, you know, all the things that have happened, they still want to protect their country. And, you know, we don't, as a society, we don't give those mobs enough credit for, you know, what they did during World War II. And you know, there's a forensic science to that, you know, to see a Japanese sub and spot it from a coastline. And then they're mini subs. They're not big ones. They're not those big, big gammon ones that got nuclear ones.
There's a massive dugong.
Yeah. You know? Oh, you can't spear that. Nah. Yeah. But, you know, that's forensic science there, you know, noticing those subtle changes and noticing something's not right and being able to do something about it. So, you know, again, we do look at forensic science with like luminol and spraying black lights everywhere, but it actually is observation and action, and that's purely what forensic science is.
How's the book been received from the education system?
Oh, yeah, it's been pretty good. You know? I mean, yeah, like I...
There's some still... parts of the education system in this country that are very Western, and stick to that very Western way of teaching, and it doesn't work for a lot of our people. So I wonder if there's any pushback or whether this has been totally embraced and something that we need to teach and put in the curriculum across the country.
Well, you know what, Kazo, you know, school didn't work for me either. I left school in year 10 and I ended up doing all my science stuff after school. So... you know, it doesn't fit for everyone. Yeah. And I'm totally in that bracket. And, you know, for me, it's been received real well because there's a lack of resources in this space. Mm. And if someone can pick it up and write a better book, I encourage them to do so because I really want more books out
there.
Just
more books, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, for me, like, there has been some pushback from, you know, the stereotypical people, that, mm-hmm. you know, the ones that remain nameless, but they've never read the book, they've never picked it up, you know, they've never looked at it. And, you know, for me, there is a want by the next generation of teachers to actually understand this stuff better. And I think that's really healthy because, you know, a lot of these teachers, they get kind of thrown under the bus. Like, they get, when they're learning their trade, they get told to go and find an Aboriginal person and ask them about culture or whatever.
Yep.
And that's pretty hard, you know. So we need to provide...
And exhausting for us.
It's exhausting. And, you know, I've been to too many high teas. I'm getting diabetes now. Nah. but, you know, it's important that, you know, we create resources that help us, you know, engage with them so they can teach blackfella perspectives in the classroom.
Yeah, it's so important. Just having that art and those stories in front of you will help your learning and your education. You know, it's just, yeah, so underestimated. Can we talk about David Unipun or Unipun?
Yeah, have you got a $50 note for me?
I was going to hit you up, Kaz. Deadly Science seems to be doing all right lately. but you do give it all away to charity, so I can't hit you up. But no, tell us about the story. I love this because he wasn't the inventor of the boomerang, but he studied it.
Yeah.
And he worked out that it created upward lift, which then gave birth to the propeller.
Yeah, well, he also had a perpetual motion machine, and he was still designing things.
He's still not recognised enough for what he did. You know, this is the black fella on the $50 note. He was an amazing scientist.
Yeah, well, you know, there was a survey done on Australians, and there was 70% of Australians didn't know who he was, and I think that's criminal. You know, there are more Australian people know who Leonardo da Vinci is than David Unipun, and... Mm. You know, I was a shearer, right? And my grandfather was a shearer. And a lot of the Walford boys and the Walga boys were shearers.
Yep.
And, you know, before the times of the electric handpiece, you used to have to use shears, which were like scissors, right? Davy and Unipun invented the electric handpiece.
Yep.
He made it so much easier. He pretty much built this country because shearing was one of the main jobs. And... For me, it was really important that, like, people acknowledge that, the fact that this man is on our $50 note, but he also was inventing things right until he passed over to the Dreamtime.
Mm.
You know, he had a perpetual motion machine that could have been used in a helicopter. You know, if he had another 10 years of life, there could have been the Unipun helicopter that was flying around, you know. And there's a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people I've met along this journey that have similar brains to Davy and Unipun. You know, I remember one time, you know, I was up in Arnhem Land, and this fella said to me, he goes, "Hey, you know, don't get close to that water there." And I'm like, "Oh, why is that?" And he goes, "There's a croc in there." And he knew there was a crocodile in there. You know, he just had that feeling, you know, and it just... You know, there's a lot of people like Davy and Unipun in this country that we just need to get our arms around and support.
Yeah,
there's a lot of young fellas too.
Yeah, so many young people that are just natural young scientists. I've met many travelling this country, and I've been very fortunate. But yeah, I often think that. So you know, I used to tell my kids, I say, when you see a helicopter or a plane up there with a propeller, think about David and Unipun. When you walk into a barbershop and get your hair cut, those electric clippers, they probably come from David Unipun, or Unipun, I think they call him down in SA there.
But you know what's interesting, right, is that some of the greatest inventions in the world, so the black box that is in aeroplanes came from Australia.
Yep.
Solar panels came from reptiles in Australia.
Really?
Yeah. Wi-Fi came from Australia.
Yep.
Electric handpieces and electric shears and motion machines came from Australia. the C-5 Boomerang, which was a World War II plane developed by the Royal Australian Air Force, was developed from the Boomerang. Yeah. And, you know, the world's most successful bush medicine that they totally stole off us. They don't advertise it as a blackfella medicine, but tea tree oil.
Yeah.
You know, it's used around the world. And this is all, like, and you know what the next big thing will be is the peptides out of the marsupial milk. So marsupials are born without an immune system. So
without
an immune system. Oh. So, you know, a baby kangaroo, a joey,
yep,
is completely hairless and pink, right? And then, you know, shout out to Andy Palo and Mob down there, but Tasmanian Devil, right, it has the world's only known infectious tumour, which is a cancer, infectious cancer, right? And the peptides and the proteins in the devil's milk provide an immunity, a limited immunity, to devil facial tumour until they reach breeding age. And, you know, superbugs are getting smarter and smarter and smarter. Mm. So penicillin, which is derived from mould, is going to be a redundant medicine eventually, because golden staff is, think of it as an organism, it's learning.
Yeah.
It learns and learns and learns. And basically the next super drugs will come out of Australian marsupials. And there's kids already working on that project. And they're working to map out the genome of the bilby. So they're up at Kirikara, which is up on the border of Western Australia, and they're picking up the bilby poo.
Yep.
They're sending it down to Sydney. They're taking DNA samples, and that's going into a big supercomputer, and it's mapping out all the genes of the bilby. Now, that's, again, blackfella's been part of this project. That's going to have real-world implications for worldwide.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we say we're the first, we never say that we used to be the scientists, because we still are.
Oh, definitely.
And even now, like, you know, when tracking bilbies and stuff, they send all the scientists with the bells and whistles with, like, you know, the wires and the drones and things like that. But the people that find them the most and the quickest are the blackfellas.
Yeah, wow. That's fascinating, bro.
Yeah.
I had no idea about any of this, because we're currently repopulating bilbies in the Pilliga scrub on my country. And that's a way, you know, obviously to care for country, but it's also a way to stop Santos.
Yeah.
You know, like more culture that's on country, the less chance mining companies have got to sort of dig it up and rip it up.
Well, you know, even...
Which isn't always the case, but...
Even koalas, right? Koalas, you know, Darug word, no drink, because they don't drink, they're not meant to drink water. They're meant to, they eat gum leaves, and the gum leaves point down.
Yep.
And the gum leaves carry all the water, so they get their water from the gum leaves. But when it's drought time, there's no water in the gum leaves, so you often see footage of firefighters giving them water and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But it actually drowns koalas if you feed them water like that, so you can't, they're not meant to drink.
Really?
Like that, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
So, but the thing is that, like, you know, how we stop companies like Santos is, you know, we need to get more citizen science in our communities so we can say, hey, we've got orange belly parrots here, we've got night parrots here, we've got bilby here, you know, we've got bog eye here, we've got, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we need to do that because it's the only way we can protect our country.
Yeah, I mean, the more deadly scientists that we have, and I guess young people don't think about it, but it is... protecting ourselves with cultural heritage, and being able to use the science of the land to protect ourselves from those companies going in.
Yeah, and you know, they pay $0 in tax too, so you know they don't pay the tax of the land, and you know we can't keep mining this country. We can't keep destroying it, because you know these animals are it's the only place that on Earth where they're found.
Mm. And is that a big part of deadly science? Is the whole, I guess, the yarn around conservation and protection?
Oh, look, I started my career as a zookeeper, so I've got a soft spot for animals, but it's about giving kids the opportunity to find their passion and purpose, because that's the both ingredients what we need. Like, you know, I love talking about animals. I can talk about animals till the cows come home. Like, I talk about Bigabilla all the time, which is echidna, right? And they're a really unique animal, because their back legs face the same way as their front legs, which is odd. They also lay eggs, which is a monotreme. They're one of two mammals. And when they're feeding their youngs, which they're called puggles, they only eat invertebrates, right, ants. But they're able to develop all this protein. So if you see a baby echidna, they're fat.
Yeah.
Like real fat. And they actually don't have teats. They actually sweat the milk out. So they don't have a teat. So they
absorb it by osmosis or
something. They basically absorb it. But they're a phenomenon, because it's like how does this thing with keratin for spikes and hair, how do they generate enough protein to make this baby so fat?
Yeah.
And you know, because they eat ants, right? And they eat termites. That's all they eat. I mean, you have to eat a lot of termites to get pretty fat. I wouldn't recommend it for your mob, you know.
You tried it, have you, bro?
You'd be waiting a while. But
one of your scientific experiments?
Well, you know, if you ever get lace monitors, right, lace monitors lay their eggs inside termite mounds, and mm-hmm. the termites go and fix, they actually go and they fix the damage once the lace monitor's laid its eggs.
Yeah.
And they're real clever because when we're at the zoo, when I was working at the zoo, used to cut the head off the termite mound, used to scoop the larvae out, and we'd give it to the echidnas and give it to all our baby lizards and snakes and things like that.
Yeah, right.
But the interesting thing about termites is animals use them to lay their eggs in because they're a natural incubator.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, the lace monitor is a very clever lizard, and they have this, you know, so most lizards, when they give birth, you're on your own. Like, you've hatched out of your egg, that's it. If you get eaten by a kookaburra or a brown snake, that's it.
Yeah.
You know? But lace monitors have this internal clock where they're like, okay, it's about time, they're about to hatch, I'm going to go dig them out. And they actually, the mum will go and dig them out. And then for that, you know, for that one time, she won't eat them. But if she comes across them again, she'll eat them.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. So she knows that her eggs are about to hatch and they need a bit of help getting out of the nest, out of the termite mound, and she'll just dig them out.
You need to do a deadly science thing called David Attenborough.
Yeah, damn man, bro.
bring all these animal stories to the world, brother, because, yeah, it's something, it's just fascinating, you know. I drove through deep water the other day, and it's platypus country.
Yeah.
And the platypus freaks me out.
Yeah.
It's just it's a baby dinosaur. I don't know, it's a half duck, half bird, half fish, I don't know.
It's also got a poison spur on its back, which...
there we go.
Which will give you, which basically the old blackfellas, they used to say that if you got stung by a platypus, they would use bush medicine to treat it. So you know where Jenolan Caves is?
Yes.
There used to be heaps of stories around there about people getting stung by platypus.
Yeah, just south of Sydney, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep. It's in the Central Tablelands.
Yeah.
And again, eDNA just recently excluded the platypus from the Royal National Park in Sydney. So they used to be found all around Lucas Heights and Dharawal Country. Mm. And then there was a bad chemical spill, big radiation chemical spill back in the 90s, and it made the platypus extinct from there. And we know because of eDNA that it's not there anymore, because if you test with eDNA, you can test the sequence of the platypus genome. So there's all that kind of stuff that, you know, there's such an elusive creature that you need kind of eDNA to see if they're there.
Yeah.
You know, I remember one time, the first ever platypus I saw, and I was down in Kangaroo Valley, and I was sitting there, I was having a cup of tea, and I sat there for about 3 hours because I knew they were there, and I just had quiet time, you know, you deep listen, and it popped its head up, looked at me, and then I never saw it again.
there's something really special about the platypus. I don't know what it is. It's just one of those unique creatures. And I remember when I was a young fella in you know, they used to freak me out, you know, in a really good way.
Yeah, well, same.
My favourite little animal was like, oh, a little platypus.
Yeah, there's something about them because, you know, my totem is the Bigabilla, which is the echidna.
Yep.
And every time I've had something major happen in my life, I've seen Bigabilla. And I'm not like, you know, I'm not someone that's like deeply religious or anything like that, but it's very much the same. If I ever see an echidna, generally means something's going to happen in my life.
Yeah.
You know, I was in my backyard in Port Macquarie, and I live in suburbia, and I saw an echidna, and I've only seen it 3 times, and all the neighbours think I'm crazy because I've seen this echidna in my backyard. I've picked it up before, and, you know, some people don't, you know, like it lives in the park down the road, but it comes in my yard, and it comes in my yard. My dog leaves it alone, and it's, you know, there's always something special about Bigabilla for me, and it's not just some... You know, it's not just the fact that they're this weird animal, but they're, you know, and the platypus are very much the same for me because they're just, there's something about them that just makes, and the same with bog eye as well, shingleback.
Yeah.
Now, you know why I love shingleback so much? Because they're the ultimate love story. They're monogamous, they breed for life. They've got this built-in GPS, so one could be in Walgett and one could be in South Australia, and if they're meant to breed and they meet each other, they'll walk kilometres to find each other, and then for 4 months of the year they're with each other.
Really?
Yeah, and it's every year. So what happens is that, you know, if you're driving like a Wamba on the highway and you hit one of them,
yeah.
they will instantly know that the other one's dead.
Really?
So they get this chemical that just builds up in their brain that knows because they're bonded. So then they're bonded. And then this is why people don't like, people need to understand our animals, that our animals think they're much more connected to each other than what people realise.
Yeah.
And they're connected to this country as well. So shinglebacks, if you know someone that takes them out of the wild or has run over a few, give them a slap across the head. Nah, don't do that. That's not advised. But they, because they mate for life, I'm surprised that shinglebacks aren't endangered because the bog eye is such a unique creature. They also, when they have their babies, right, they're half the size of an adult.
Yeah.
Like, right. Imagine if you were giving birth and you were giving birth to a 10 or a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Pretty wild. But that's what they do. And they're really special creatures, and I've got a real strong connection to them because, I used to pick them up when I was a kid, going between Lightning Ridge and Tumby Bay and all those places. Yeah. They're just a really unique creature, and they've all got a third eye as well, which is all reptiles have this parallel eye, which allows them to see in colour. So it's a clear skull. If you ever see a blue tongue lizard, they've got this clear diamond scale on their head, and it's got a little dot in it, and that little dot collects the UV rays and allows them to see in colour. So when you catch a croc, when you all become zookeepers,
yeah,
I hope you do. you'll notice that they you always put a rag over the crocodile's head because you cover up that parallel eye and it makes it think it's night time.
Yeah, right. This is fascinating, brother.
Yeah.
We definitely need a David Attenborough series to come out through Deadly Science. It's just fascinating. How little we know about our animals and. I guess their lives, you know. Is there a word, because we are heavily connected to our animals and to our land, is there a word that sort of describes that connection? Because, you know, we're just talking about how, the affinity that you have with your echidna. I was talking about the platypus. We have these affinity with animals. Is there a word that sort of talks to that connection?
Not that I can work out in my head. I don't know at all, but if anyone's got that suggestion, let us know.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it?
But, you know, the interesting thing about Barinda, right, which is kangaroo, I remember my pop saying to me when I was young, he goes, they're always given birth. They've always got babies. And it's true. You know, if they've got a joey at foot, they've got another two. So they're kind of ready to, they're always ready to drop their babies at a drop of a hat because they've always got two more. So, like, you know, when you're out bush and you're driving and sometimes what happens is that when they get stressed, when they see cars, they drop their joey, if you've ever heard of that. They drop their joey and the joey's, you're on your own, you know, see you later. They've always got another two ready to go. So they're designed to be eaten.
Yeah, right.
They're designed to be eaten and they're designed to be, you know, food.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was always a set of rules around it. You know, you didn't take young females. You took old buck. You took the, you know, there was always one buck, but you always took the young male that, you know, was always going to be second.
Yeah.
You know, and so for me, there's no word that I can think of in Gamilaroi language, but there's always a set of rules with our animals that we abide by, that we looked after them.
Yeah.
And whether that's planting different plants to attract them or you know, having those rules like with Barinda, we didn't take too much.
Yeah, and I learned a lot about the barramundi just by fishing with mob in the top end. And they used to catch this big 1 meter ones, and I was like, woohoo, we're eating for a week. And then they'd chuck it back in. I'm like, hey, why'd you chuck it back in, Rex Hunt? What's going on?
And they said, hope you didn't kiss it.
Yeah, no. Too slimy. But they're the breeders.
Yeah.
They're the breeders, and barramundi's hermaphrodites, and they change sex and so forth. So just for sitting with the mob and fishing, we only took the smaller ones because they're the eaten ones, and the big ones you chuck back in to breed and just leave them be. And I just thought that was really, it's a really cool thing.
You know what the most amazing creature is by far? Barramundi, for example, they can be both saltwater and freshwater. They develop this slime, which coats them from the salinity of the water. But eels are the most fascinating creatures, the freshwater eel.
Go, Parramatta. Sorry, bro.
Nah, that's disgusting. Gross. You won't win a premiership till the sun explodes. And but anyway, the eels are really funny because no one really knows how they breed. So if you have like eels that are in, you know, Lining Ridge or in the dams or whatever, they eventually make their way out to New Caledonia, and they breed, die, and then the babies come back.
Wow.
So if you've ever been to the Botanic Gardens in, yeah, even the ones in Botanic Gardens in Brisbane up in Gubbi Gubbi country, or, you know, they're the ones that will go out to the Pacific Ocean. And
so they swim across the ocean.
They swim across the ocean. And yeah, that's why when the Darug people knew this, and that's why Parramatta was called Parramatta. That's why Parramatta are called the Parramatta eels, because they knew that they were swimming out the heads through the Parramatta River. And but they've tracked them to New Caledonia. So when they empty out in the Royal Botanic Gardens of Sydney, they empty out the ponds because obviously there's a lot of complaints for eels eating ducklings and things like that.
Yeah, right.
And they'll put them in Sydney Harbour. They'll just chuck them in Sydney Harbour, and they always find their way back. So the eels are the most fascinating creature, I think, that we have, because we know next to nothing about them.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, mob eat them and stuff, but they're in Western New South Wales and they find their way out to New Caledonia, and they're not jumping on a P&O cruise. you know, they're getting out there. So
the old freshwater snake, we used to call them back in the day.
Yeah.
Didn't like them at all.
But they're real clever too, because they develop this slime membrane,
mm-hmm.
and it prevents them from drying out, so they can go across land. So even though they're an aquatic animal, in drought times they do die, but even though like they're an aquatic animal, they develop this membrane, which is kind of like like, you know, when you have a snail and it leaves that trail?
Yeah.
So that's done by gastropods develop the sort of same sort of slime, but eels actually can develop it as well, and it's pretty unique. They're pretty cool creatures. I mean, one came up to me at the I was in the Botanic Gardens yesterday. One came up and it was just looking at me, and I'm like, "Your dinner?" I'm kidding. They taste bad.
You're probably looking at you, thinking the same.
Yeah, probably.
mate, we've got the Brisbane Writers Fest on tonight. People can come along and check it out. What do you want people, just before we sort of wrap it up, what do you want people to take away from this book, you know, whether it be adults or young people? What do you want them to take away from this book? And I guess the whole deadly science experience.
Look, deadly science isn't a saviour complex. It's a collaboration. It's not outreach. I hate the word outreach. Let's do something. Let's make people ban the word outreach about people. Our people don't need help being smarter. They just need help finding their passion and purpose.
Yeah,
and
well said.
And for me, deadly science is about, you know, and my hope for deadly science is I'm not the CEO in 10 years. I hope one of my kids is, you know, and not some of that family crap that you see, you know, one of my deadly scientists.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason for that is because, you know, I think that all kids should have access to things like Lego, things like, you know, microscopes. You know, we should be able to do two-way science in, you know, we know our culture, but we should be able to work in both worlds.
Yeah.
And for me, my hope, my biggest takeaway is that, you know, when you support deadly science, you know, don't think of it as a Corey Tutt thing. Think of it as a community thing, because this organisation, we are going to be the most transparent Indigenous organisation that exists. So we're going to be providing reports on impact. We're going to be providing reports on in-kind support, and there's going to be no BS in between, because I need to
can see where the money goes. 100%. That's the biggest thing, right?
Yeah.
Where's the money going, bruh?
But it needs to go.
A new deadly science car, bruh. You
know, yeah, you know? Shout out Lexus. I really want people to, I really want deadly science to be transparent with Melbourne, and, you know, and also I want everyone to be involved in it in some way, you know, and that's the main thing. And I hope people see that it's authentic. It's not, yeah, it's not, we're not the flashiest, you know, car in the yard, but we're going to be the one that gets you there.
You've got a pretty good engine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's it. Yeah.
No, thanks for coming in today, brother. It's always a pleasure. You're going to jump back in once a month for me.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to do a deadly science segment.
He's giving me a couple of Europons.
you'll be giving them to me later. Don't worry about that. But you can catch Corey tonight with myself for the Stories of Stars. It's at the State Library here in Brisbane. It's a free event, so come along, mob. Come along and have a yarn and learn. And You can pick up a copy of The First Scientist, Deadly Inventions and Innovations from Australia's First People. Get out there and buy it for your kids and particularly your non-Indigenous mob, because you might just learn something. That's it for our show today. Corey, thanks again. Shout out to all the Walgett mob and all your family out there, brother, all the Walfords, especially you, Uncle Cab. But I'm going to play a little Roger Knox song for you now and your family. Thanks for listening to AAA Murray Country.